Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors. Asking the questions no one else asks. Creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropsik. And John, there are many theories as to why we find ourselves with this gap, this income inequality in America. And how do we right this ship so that our politics can be less angry and vitriolic? Because a lot of this is built on resentment and knowing that something's wrong in the land and that you're being left behind. And we've got to come up with some solutions. And I know a lot of the presidential candidates are talking about the 1% and the like. And I think people want to know, I mean, can I make it? Can my kids really enter the middle class in a way that is going to be secure for the long term?
Well, I really think the middle class is disappearing. I think we're seeing the haves and the have-nots, and then the middle is, and I believe that is the problem with our society right now. We don't have jobs where people can excel, you know, start as maybe a shipping person and become the CEO of the corporation anymore. You know, you don't, I don't think there's as much
movement and upward mobility.
For young people and people to get into the workplace.
Well, you know, what's interesting, John, and I think you're right, but Democrats often blame big, bad corporate America, and they spent a lot of money getting their agenda passed through Congress, big corporate America, there's no question. And yet the GOP, they look at perhaps immigrants and others, and they're taking your job, maybe bad trade deals, whatever it may be. But the gentleman we have with us today, who's written a book called A Republic of Equals, Jonathan Rothwell, he is the chief economist for the Gallup organization, you know, the Gallup poll. Uh-huh. And it's a really great organization, as we know. So while everyone's got their talking points about why we are where we are, and I don't think anybody really disagrees that we've got some issues we've got to address in this regard, we add a whole new dimension today on this podcast to that discussion. And he describes what he calls, John, a disparity in power across groups. Now, you know, this is something you got to stay with, folks, when you start listening to him. And he makes it very clear what he's saying. But he thinks that there are other reasons for this income inequality. He thinks certain job types are valued at a much higher level than perhaps is justified, and that we are becoming so exclusionary where we are now walling off various occupations. If you don't have a license to do this, then you are not able to do it. And of course, that many occupations are able to set new rates for themselves that may be a little outsized in relation to others who have great skills, but in fact, they're just not part of a group that has walled itself off and made certain that it's harder to get into that club, if you will.
I agree with him there. I think teaching is one that I think they've really walled off, and you got to have a master's degree to teach, and you got to have, they've made it so that a lot of people, you know, retirees and stuff who really have a lot of good smarts couldn't even get in a system, let alone teach.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are so many careers. I mean, he looks at doctors and lawyers. So you're going to find this very different. Yeah. And you're going to have to open your mind up if you're on one side or the other of this debate politically and say maybe there's room in here for another aspect of the conversation. So he suggests that the parties are taking aim at the wrong targets in this income inequality debate. Want to hear about this?
Yeah, I agree with him. I think I think we attack the rich people, and which is stupid. And I think, we attack corporations, and there is a lot more to it than that.
All right. Well, let's hear about it from our guest today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Jonathan Rothwell, and he's got an incredible book out called Republic of Equals, a manifesto for a just society. And you take on this topic of a more equal society just at a moment in time, Jonathan, when the numbers suggest we're going in the opposite direction. And, of course, we go back to our Pledge of Allegiance with liberty and justice for all. I mean, what's really happening in America? Are we moving away from that ideal more than we're going and converging in its direction?
Well, I think we do have many political liberties that in some ways over the course of U.S. history have gotten better in a way with slavery. The severe oppression of the Jim Crow system has largely been eroded thanks to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And certainly gender equality is much better than it used to be. So in some ways, we're a more politically egalitarian country than ever before. And yet we face a fairly significant income inequality across individuals, but also across race. And that's a real concern, and it's gotten worse, according to all the best have, at least since 1980. And the book really is wrestling with what are the fundamental causes of that.
And of course, you're somebody who's an empiricist. You work with Gallup. So you're not just talking about, your thoughts or your feelings. A lot of what you have in the book is based on the numbers.
Correct. Yeah, there's quite a bit of data out there in terms of the trend on income inequality, the level of inequality in the United States, how it compares to other countries. I dig into international survey data, which helps me identify who's in the upper income brackets across the world and what patterns that reveals in terms of how markets are working or not working in various countries to affect the income distribution.
And if our goal is a just society, and you have put forward a manifesto for one, what would a republic of equals look more like than America looks like today? In other words, what do we really have to look at, and what numbers are most important in this equation?
So I think of it as two major components that are missing, and it's not that we need fundamental radical change necessarily. I think it's really just moving more in the direction of what the framers of the Constitution intended when they attempted to create a republic that was at that time, with the exception of slavery, founded on fairly egalitarian principles. So The two things that I focus on in the book are making public goods and services more equitable. And so the most obvious and important in terms of how it relates to income would probably be educational services. So for decades, we've had very extreme levels of segregation in the United States, and that affects kids' access to school. The segregation is not only by but also by class, and increasingly so by income and class. And that presents a real challenge in terms of providing equal access to high-quality public goods and services, because education, but also other public services, are provided at the neighborhood level. So that's one thing that as a country we need to improve and focus on. And then the other one is really about providing equal access to markets. And this is one that I think has been neglected in political science discussions about what it means to be a democracy, what it means to have political rights. The emphasis has always been on voting rights and other aspects of civil liberties that are defined in the U.S. Bill of Rights. But what's really been missing, and I argue, is a focus on access to markets. And so there are several ways that I think access to markets are limited and to certain groups of people. Historically, African Americans were not allowed to, or explicitly not allowed to participate in housing markets or labor markets as professionals. They were barred from participation in the American Bar Association and the American Medical Association until the middle of the 20th century, at least from full participation, depending on what state they were in. And access to education through even buying access to the private services provided by private higher education institutions was limited. So that's an obvious example, but it's extended into the 21st century by the distortion of housing markets. I spent a fair amount of time in the book describing how local zoning laws prohibit the free exchange of property and the construction of lower income housing, apartment buildings, even attached single family homes in many rich neighborhoods. And that is largely because homeowners don't want to protect the value of their properties, and they believe that building higher density homes near their house will deplete their property values. So that's one important example. And then I extend the analysis of access to markets to professional services.
And I do want to get into that, but before we do, but the Republicans, of course, they talk about immigration and its impact on income inequality, people taking away the jobs of native-born Americans. They also talk about individualist, the rugged individual, and they don't really ascribe some of the blocks that we might find toward groups that in our own midst might be putting up barriers to the success and achievement. And you point this out in your book, and I think people are going to be startled to hear what it is you have to say about both the abilities of those at various levels of income and some of the organizations and associations that might be more at the root of income inequality.
Right. So just to quickly take on the immigration issue, it is true that there's been a large inflow of immigrants with very low levels of education, and that's put, I believe, some downward pressure on wages for workers competing with them. But that does not explain the rise of top incomes. People in the 1% are not typically employing immigrants, and certainly in any disproportionate way. If you look at hedge funds, for example, they're certainly not hiring immigrants with low levels of education to do the financial analysis for them. And so it's hard to make any kind of connection there between the rise in income inequality and immigration. Secondly, too, the point about individuals, I do think it's true that the Republican Party and folks on the right tend to emphasize individual talent in explaining why some people are more successful than others. And I wouldn't want to entirely dismiss that, but it's just not the case that people in the top 1% stand out on average compared to people who are not in the top 1% on the traits and characteristics that are most associated with higher income earnings and success in the labor market. So that would be things like IQ and cognitive ability, as well as non-cognitive personality traits like conscientiousness, emotional stability. Those things are well measured in surveys, both internationally and in the United States. And in the book, I spend a fair amount of time analyzing those data. And what I find is that people in the top 1% are slightly above average, but really don't stand out on any of those traits relative to people who are quite a bit below them in terms of income earnings, but still, moderately high income earners. So an example I cite in the book is that African Americans with a master's degree have the same level of IQ as the average CEO in the United States. And yet only 1% of African Americans with a master's degree are in the top 1%. And so clearly it's not just that you need to be smart to be in the top 1% and that everyone in the top 1% is super intelligent and talented. There just really isn't any evidence to support that. And what I think is more relevant to consider, which gets to your point about groups, is that certain occupational and professional and industry groups really stand out as being overrepresented in the 1%. And we know through detailed economic studies that there are advantages that their interest groups have created for them that give them extra income.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Now explain to us, you say, and this may surprise people, that doctors, lawyers, dentists, financial managers are often overpaid for their labor. I mean, we as a society value what they do, so why are they overpaid relative to perhaps the rest of us?
Great question. They're overpaid relative to what the market would otherwise compensate them for, because there are specific rules and regulations that govern, in the case of doctors and lawyers, the degree of competition that they face. So the sort of obvious rules are ones that limit entry. It's very expensive to go to medical school and law school. It requires giving up many years of your life to get that training. And that's obviously going to limit the supply. There's also immigration laws that limit the supply of people in those occupations. But I think even more importantly than those specific rules is the fact that state governments in the United States give doctors and lawyers a monopoly on the services that they provide, and they prevent other people who are also qualified to provide at least some of those services with the opportunity to do so. And so some examples I discussed in the book with, in the case of physicians is the fact that nurse practitioners are trained to provide family and general practice medical services.
Mm-hmm.
But in most states, and in the largest states, they're not allowed to do so except for under the supervision of a physician. And so if you're a nurse practitioner in California or New York, you can't open your own clinic and provide the services you're trained to provide unless you're under the direct supervision of a physician who is probably going to be taking most of the profits of any medical practice. And in fact, we see that doctors are one of the most overrepresented groups in the top 1%. They're in fact the largest occupational group in the 1%. About 18% of people in the 1% are doctors, which compares to 11% being CEOs. So they're more prominent in the 1% than CEOs even. And I think a big reason for that is the rules and regulations that the American Medical Association, through the decades of lobbying, has carved out for them.
So we have a power differential. They are represented. It's ironic that unions have fallen away in the private sector, and yet, in a sense, these associations, backed by powerful lobbyists, have been able to perhaps artificially boost the incomes of some in our society to the detriment of others.
Right. So, yeah, there's been quite a bit of talk, especially on the political left, about the role of unions, the declining role of unions. Certainly there are fewer workers that are in unions nowadays, and that's largely the result, I think, of the decline in manufacturing jobs as a share of total employment. Some of it, though, would also be the movement of jobs from the Northeast and Midwest to southern states where union laws are less strict about and workers are not compelled to join unions in the same way they are in the Midwest. But that also, I think, is hard to connect really in a strong way to the rise of 1%, because fewer and fewer CEOs and even workers in general come from the manufacturing sector in the 1%. That's been a declining source of riches across the board. And if you look at the industries where people are more likely to be in the 1%, it's really professional services, it's finance, it's healthcare, it's legal services, comprise a very large chunk of top income earners. And these are sectors that were never unionized. It's hard to say that it's a case where CEOs are extracting too much income from their workers. In the case of law firms and doctor's offices and hedge funds, in many cases, the people who are workers are also the owners themselves. And that's related to a major trend in the legal organization of the top income earning businesses. They're much more likely to be partnerships and S corporations.
So you're saying the S corporations more than the C, the larger publicly held entities that are really at the root of this. By the way, the book is called Republic of Equals, A Manifesto for a Just Society. Jonathan Rothwell is with us. Jonathan, you talked about the Democrats and the way that perhaps their target isn't spot on in terms of the problems that we're having as it relates to income inequality. The Republicans put it at the doorstep of immigrants. They say we should all individually be able to raise ourselves up by our bootstraps. And yet you're able to point to associations and organizations that might be protecting people and enhancing their incomes beyond what is appropriate in our society. And they seem much closer to home than some of the targets we're talking about.
That's right. So just to take the case of the immigration issue quickly, I do think there's been some downward pressure on the wages of less educated workers as a result of the large-scale immigration of people largely from Latin America with somewhat lower levels of education than the average American. But that's not really an important cause of the rise of income inequality in the United States, because people at the top of the income distribution really aren't affected by that. It's more, you know, keeping wages down somewhat, and that's even debatable among less educated workers. Now, as for another major cause of income inequality that we hear discussed on the political right, we often hear that it comes down to individual talent and that people in the 1% are just smarter or more talented than everyone else. Now, I looked into this in quite a bit of detail and conclude that really there is no strong evidence for this. In fact, there's strong evidence against that idea. Not that there aren't very talented people in the 1%. There's certainly some fantastic entrepreneurs that are extremely bright and have come up with brilliant ideas. But when you look across a large swath of the 1%, what you really find is that on average, they look just a little bit above average, and certainly not so far above average that it would justify their level of income. So what I looked at in the book are things like cognitive ability, IQ scores, and non-cognitive traits, all of which are predictive of higher income. That would include things like conscientiousness and emotional stability in terms of non-cognitive traits. And really the 1% look quite a bit like other people who are above average income earners. And an example that I mentioned in the book is that African Americans with a master's degree have the same IQ scores as the average CEO in the United States. And yet African Americans with a master's degree are very rarely in the top income, among top income earners. And so clearly there's more to the story than just talent. And so that gets to the last part of your question, which is really a big part of the analysis of the book, that there are interest groups that for decades have lobbied often at the local level and distorted markets to the benefit of their members and the expense of everyone else. And that has
a big role to play in why certain groups, certain occupational and industry groups stand out in terms of overrepresentation in the 1%.
And you talk about doctors and lawyers and dentists. And of course, they have these occupational licensing requirements that really elevate their skills, limit the number of people who get in. And this is at the same time when in our society, those who want to join one of the craft unions or whatever, that is diminishing so dramatically. Now, not that they would be in the 1%, but if you're looking for ways that certain people are going up the scale and other people are staying the same or, relatively speaking, with inflation and the like going down, that might be a contributor overall.
Well, I think that it's unions represent an interesting case in terms of the income inequality more generally. They come up a lot in terms of the discussion because as income inequality has increased, it is true that the percentage of workers in unions has diminished. But in terms of the causal relationship between unionization and income inequality, it just isn't there in any strong way. The reason I say that is because the industries that are overrepresented in the 1% include more local, domestic, closely held businesses, S corporations and partnerships that are providing usually some kind of professional service or highly skilled service like finance, hedge funds, real estate companies, law offices and physicians' offices. And these are industries that never had unionized workers. But I think another point that you're bringing up in terms of how people can move up in the income distribution through training and acquiring technical skills. One of the things I talk about a lot in the book is the fact that the American Medical Association, American Bar Association, and other major players in the occupational licensing world have made it very difficult for otherwise qualified technicians to compete with the elite professionals in their membership organizations. So, for example, dental hygienists, nurse practitioners, and paralegals all face very severe restrictions on the types of services that they're allowed to provide because of laws that have been created by the American Dental Association, American Medical Association, American Bar Associations.
It would seem that some of the issues that you're raising in your book about inequality can be addressed. However, we do look at various political barriers to building this Republic of Equals, which is the name of the book that we're talking about today with Jonathan Rothwell. And it would seem as if leaders misunderstand really what is going on here. And even if they do accept your argument that there are these associations that wield so much power in our society, and yet they're generally looked upon not in a sinister way, in the way that many of the other bogeymen that both parties point to often are portrayed.
That's right. And I mean, to be clear, I don't believe they have sinister intentions. And I'm grateful for the fact that we have physicians and lawyers who are well-trained and that there are occupation. I'm not even against occupational licensing in principle. I think we do want a world where consumers can feel safe and secure, that they're buying services that are provided by genuine experts, and the occupational licensing regime creates that confidence. But the problem is that after decades of lobbying, these organizations have created markets that are so distorted and so biased toward their members that it's really cutting into what public benefits would otherwise be available to everyone, and come at the expense of ordinary workers and consumers. And so I think just like the Federal Trade Commission at the federal level looks out with a skeptical eye toward big market players and influencers to try to look for ways that they are distorting markets, We need something like an FTC at the state level to operate on behalf of consumers.
Thank you for being with us today on America Trends. America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.